Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm excited to speak with Ayan Zubair, who's an associate in Allen Overy LLP's New York office. Ayan's practice focuses on commercial litigation, intellectual property litigation, and white-collar investigations. He also maintains a robust pro bono practice consisting of indigent criminal defense, immigration, and small business assistance matters. I've been following Ayan's advice on LinkedIn for quite some time, where he posts about tips for success in your first years of practice. And so often on the podcast, I speak with folks who are a bit more senior in their career, so I was really excited to get this opportunity today. Before entering private practice, he was a law clerk to Justice Lydia Stiglitz of the Nevada Supreme Court. He's a 2021 graduate of the University of California Berkeley School of Law, Go Bears, and Stony Brook University, Go Seawolves, where he was president of the undergraduate student government, among other scholarships and accolades. Thanks so much for being here. I'm super excited we could do this.
Thank you for having me, Jonah. Really appreciate the kind introduction.
So look, let's start at the beginning. When did you decide to become a lawyer? Was this always the plan, or was this some moment where you decided, I'm going to join this profession?
Quite honestly, it was very much a process of elimination. I went to college to study biomedical engineering. And about the third day or so of college, I realized I hate chemistry, I hate biology. Maybe going down this path isn't the way to go. And for a while, I was kind of unsure what I wanted to do, right? Bounce around different classes, different majors. And then I started thinking about what I actually like doing in my free time. And that's I'm kind of a nerd, so I like to read the New York Times, read the politics section, and reading these debates over constitutional norms and laws. And I started thinking, what can I do that can help me make a living in this thing I enjoy? And I realized, well, going to law school, all you do is read and write, right? And being a lawyer, that's what you do. So why not? And so I took a gamble, paid off, really enjoyed law school, and really enjoyed my career so far.
Yeah, that's great. I think one of the biggest challenges is when you're picking sort of what you want to do in your career, we get this advice of like, do what you love and you'll never work a day of your life. And there's some truth to that, but I also find that like a better version of that is do the thing that you do if nobody was watching, which is a little bit different than do the thing you love and do the things you're good at. And it sounds like you sort of took that path.
Totally. I mean, look, I think at the end of the day, look, a job is a job. I mean, if you told anyone, hey, you know, would you rather do your job or, you know, be on the beach and go to a Taylor Swift concert? For the most people, they probably choose the latter, right? But yeah, I think that's totally right.
Sure.
Go towards what you're good at and you'll find a way to make a living out of it.
I love that. And did you have a lot of interaction with lawyers sort of when you were growing up? Did you know a lot of lawyers, or was this a kind of a big surprise when you joined the profession?
Honestly, so I grew up on Long Island from an immigrant Muslim community, and there really wasn't any lawyers growing up. And quite honestly, the only interactions we ever had with the law were negative interactions post 9/11, right? And I remember being a kid and seeing that we never had anyone to represent us, to be the voice of our community, right? I think that was another thing that drove me to law school, right? Which was the best way to advance the cause of my community is to learn the laws that, you know, sometimes have been used disproportionately against them as well.
Yeah, that's great. One of my former guests, who I think you know, Javeria Khan, who's the founder of the Appellate Project, just published recently an article about the importance of making the legal profession look like American society because of the sort of outsized impact that the profession has on those communities. And so I'll put that in the show notes if I remember, but I think that's also great. So you are one of my most recent graduates from law school that I've had on the podcast so far. And so it's a little fresher. And I guess my question is, your first couple years into practice, is there anything you wished you knew when you were in law school or anything you wished you did in law school that would have set you up better for sort of the first couple years of your career?
Nothing comes to mind as to that, but actually the inverse comes to mind, which is what are some things that I did that in hindsight actually really helped me, right?
Great. Sure. Love that.
And so I'm a class of 2021 grad, so half of my law school was online, right? You know, Zoom School of Law and all that.
Right.
And so I realized somewhere in my 3L year that, okay, taking these courses on Zoom, of course, they're valuable and we have great professors at Berkeley, but getting practical experience would be so much better, especially because at that point I knew I was going to clerk, right? And so the spring of my 3L year, I did two externships, one at the Center for Constitutional Rights and one at the Legal Aid Society's Special Litigation Unit in New York. And both of those gave me really practical experiences dealing with clients, learning how to use Westlaw, being accountable to senior attorneys, right? And all those things is primarily what I do right now at my job, right, in different contexts. So I think that experience, and this is what I recommend to every law student, is no matter what you're interested in, and whether it be litigation, transactional work, whatever it is, try to get experiential opportunities when you're in law school, because it's a pretty low risk proposition, right? If you don't like it, it's a couple of weeks, it's a semester, it's a summer.
Right.
As opposed to going down this path as a full-time attorney and realizing three years down the road, you don't really like tax law.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think there's a lot of, I think legal education gets a lot of flack because it seems people always say you spend 3 years taking exams and then you actually like take the bar exam to learn the law and start doing things. But actually law school has become much more experiential, even in the sort of decade since I was a law student, I guess decade plus now at this point, since I was a law student. And it sounds like those experiences were helpful to you. And I think ultimately that's what I recommend to all my students as well.
And I think doing experiential work also helps you become a better law student as well, right? Because, you know, civil procedure seems kind of arcane. And when I was taking it my 1L year, I didn't understand why this actually mattered.
Totally.
Right? And then when I was at Legal Aid, excuse me, and CCR, I saw how civil procedure decided so many cases, right? I mean,
yes.
Fed courts, right? I mean, at CCR, a big chunk of what I was doing at Legal Aid as well was qualified immunity cases. And that's all Fed courts, right? So I became so much better at my substantive knowledge by doing the work on the ground.
I love that. And before we dive into sort of what you're doing today, you mentioned that you knew that you wanted to and were eventually going to clerk, and you had an opportunity to clerk on a state Supreme Court. First, I'd love to hear sort of how did you land there? It sounds like you grew up in New York. You were going to school sort of on Zoom and sort of in California. How'd you end up at the state Supreme Court of Nevada?
So I think one thing that clerking allows you to do is a trial run of a certain area, or, you know, like you're not wed to that area, right? So as to why Nevada, I think it was like, let's try it out, see how it is. But more so as to why I chose to do a state Supreme Court and why I chose to do a fellow clerkship was I saw in law school, I was really interested in the questions of why rather than what, right? So, like, you know, why is the law this certain way, right? Or like one of the favorite questions I love getting asked in law school was how and where should we draw the line?
Right.
Right. And appellate courts deal with that day in and day out, developing tests or even applying tests from previous cases. And the thing with state Supreme Courts is they're the courts of last resort for the vast majority of cases in their jurisdiction, right? And so it was honestly like a similar experience with the United States Supreme Court, right? Mm-hmm. I knew that wouldn't happen for me. So I was like, you know what, let me get a good opportunity here. I mean, and Justice Stiglitz in particular, what drew me to her was she's a former public defender. And so I thought that was a really cool experience and a perspective through which to analyze the law. So I think that's what attracted me to her and then to the state Supreme Court in general.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about what it was like. Like, what was it like to clerk on the court? What kind of work did you do?
There's sometimes this negative perception of state courts, especially at law schools, especially, you know, the quote unquote, whatever, T14 or whatever, right? They're seen as almost less than. Even I heard some comments about like, oh, well, you couldn't have gotten something better, right? And first of all, I think that's completely absurd, right? And if you want to practice in a jurisdiction, especially, clerking in a state Supreme Court there is amazing experience.
Right.
And as for my day-to-day, the opportunities I got were pretty varied and diverse, right? So a lot of civil cases, right? So personal injury cases, for example, it was in Vegas, right? So a lot of cases came out of the strip and hotels and casinos. Criminal docket, super interesting. I'm very interested in criminal law as well. And the opportunity to do cases that applied the Fourth Amendment and these kind of things, super helpful. Other constitutional cases, election law cases, I mean, water rights, it runs the whole gamut.
And can you talk a little bit about, for someone who's sort of not familiar with clerking or clerking at a state Supreme Court, what the day-to-day life was like? Like, you know, what role did you play in cases? What role did you play in opinion drafting? And obviously, every court and every judge, frankly, is a little bit different, but I'm curious about your experience.
I think this is probably true of Federal Court of Appeals clerkships as well. I mean, and Jonah, you've done one of those. Maybe this relates to what you did as well, which is my job as a law clerk was, okay, a case has come to Nevada Supreme Court. And also one quick point to note is Nevada has an intermediary court of appeal, but for the vast majority of cases, it goes straight from the trial court to the Supreme Court.
Oh, wow.
So it's the court of first appeal and most of the time the court of last appeal as well, right? So it's an interesting dynamic there.
It is interesting, yeah.
So the job of the law clerk there is, okay, there was a trial below, let's say, for example, right? And the part that lost is appealing. So to go to the trial record, and go through the briefs, and write what's called a bench memo, right? Analyzing, okay, you know, the appellant has made, you know, four arguments. Okay, appellant says X, respondent says Y. This is what happened in the case. This is the law surrounding this issue, whatever that may be, right? And then giving your analysis based on the cases you reviewed and applying those to the facts, right? So in one sense, it's very much like law school, right? CREACing, that's the name of the game. And then what happens is once you write the bench memo and once it gets distributed to the justices, they vote, right? And so either it's a panel of three justices or seven, depending on if it's en banc or not. And then once they vote, they decide, you know, we're going to go this way or that way, or, right, there's a majority or dissent. And then obviously, depending on where my justice lands, I would either help them author the majority opinion or the dissent. And helping the justice craft the opinion is super, super cool because you get to see behind the curtain, right? Uh-huh. We all read opinions in law school. Right. But we never actually get to see, you know, how the sausage is made, for lack of a better term. Right. And I think that experience was really, really cool. And also really helped my legal writing ability because it showed me how much better my justice was in legal writing than me, obviously. Right.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like watching Jordan play basketball.
I love that. Yeah.
Just by like osmosis, you got better just by looking at him.
Right. And if you can you say a little bit more about how that sausage gets made? Like, how did you, at least in your chambers, think about the process of drafting an opinion?
I think what's really important for law students who think about clerking is to understand that you are in service of the justice and in service of the court, mm-hmm. right? So when a decision is made, right, it is your job to execute that, right? And of course, my justice welcomed my opinions, right?
Sure.
And welcomed, you know, if I disagreed, hey, like, okay, let's talk it out, right? But once a decision is made, you know, I can't be like, well, I'm not going to draft the opinion because I disagree with you, right? That's not how this works, right? I mean,
right.
The opinions were signed off as her name, not my name, right?
Right.
So that's the first thing. And I think the second thing is it helps you realize the power of almost like a good outline, right? Because if the bench memo is very good and the justices vote in accordance to the bench memo, the opinion kind of writes itself, right? For the most part, the substantive portion of it. I think what's really cool was to see how the justices used word choice, right? And there was Ross Guberman, right? He does a lot of, like, he's a legal writing guru, right?
Right, yeah.
But yeah, one point that he notes all the time is look to the introduction of an opinion because you'll see how the authoring judge or justice narrates the facts and that'll give away what the holding will be.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? And so that's something that I learned that, and how to craft that was super helpful. And now doing persuasive writing, right?
Right.
And being in that position from the litigant's perspective as opposed to the judge's perspective.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think sometimes we talk about opinions as, occasionally I hear the word objective used in terms of like, right. An opinion is objective legal writing. But in reality, first of all, it's rarely objective because it's the opinion of a judge or group of judges. And especially,
it's called an opinion.
Right. Right. It's a really, really good point. But also thinking about the opinion and a bench memo, frankly, as a persuasive document, I think is a really thought-provoking way of thinking about that document because it's just a matter of who you're persuading. The audience is different. Is that right?
Totally. And especially when there's a dissent or concurrence, right? Mm-hmm. Because you are presenting competing views here, right, of what transpired and why the law dictates a different result.
Yes.
And so I think that's super fascinating, right? And I actually used to love helping my justice with her drafting, you know, opinions or dissents when there were opinions or dissents, right? And seeing the justice sit down and debate them, and sometimes we're able to observe that as well, was just, it was like being a fly in the wall of like, you think of like the Constitutional Convention or something like that, right? It seems like something similar to that. Especially with cases that had constitutional valence, I thought that was super fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. Not to use the Hamilton reference, but you get to be in the room where it happens, which is fantastic. Yeah. So let's turn to talk a little bit about what you do day to day now as a litigation associate at a big law firm in New York. I know that maybe people who are listening to this a month from now or so when it's published are going to be doing just that and thinking, what are my days going to be like? What are my weeks going to be like? What are my months going to be like? Talk to me a little bit about what I'd see if I followed you around.
So I think I've had a pretty awesome experience because I've had a very varied experience. And so as you know at the top of the show that I do a lot of different things, right? So I help out some commercial litigation matters. I help out some white-collar investigations matters. I do some intellectual property work both in our life sciences group and in our tech group. And so all of these experiences as a junior is super helpful because it allows me to see the diverse practice areas, even within litigation. Mm-hmm. And to that point, I think in law school, you know, they kind of frame it as, okay, litigation is this one bucket and this transactional is another bucket, right? But in reality, there's so many variations of each of those practice areas, right? Within corporate, there's, you know, M&A, there's capital markets, there's leverage finance. And with litigation, even there, there's white collar, there's commercial litigation. Within commercial litigation, right, there might be securities, bankruptcy, so on and so forth.
Sure.
And so I think as a junior, day-to-day role, right, looks like assisting in brief drafting, right? Assisting, obviously, document review is a big thing as a junior associate. But also, I think the reason I really love this firm is that the senior associates and the partners really value my input, right? And so it's not just being a passive kind of fly on the wall, so to speak, right? Just
right.
Doing what you're told. But if you have a theory, if you see something, say something, right? Let them know. And just the other day, I spoke to a partner about something I saw, and he was like, oh, that's great. Let's try to incorporate that, right? And so I think one thing I would say to those people who are listening right now, who might be starting as an associate in a couple of weeks or a couple of months, is be proactive, right? If you want an opportunity, go get that opportunity, right? And make it seem like you're interested, because people will really value that.
I like that. I think people do value interest. I think I saw that in my time as a junior in litigation as well. One of the big critiques of sort of like big law, junior litigation, New York City, is hours and work-life mm-hmm. balance and case balance. Talk to me a little bit about how you've dealt with those issues over the last couple of years.
I think it is no secret, right? This job, sometimes there are long hours involved, right? But one thing I would say is, it's not just big law that has long hours, right?
Sure.
If you're at a boutique firm, if you're in government, public interest, if a court imposes crazy turnaround time,
right,
you're going to have to file a brief in that time, right? So I think that is kind of, in litigation, I think it's better than in the transactional realm in certain senses, right? Because you usually have a case scheduling order and these kind of things. But I think in terms of work-life balance, right, I see this other term used a lot that I like, is something like work-life integration or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the idea that it's not when I'm at work, my life stops. And when I'm not at work, don't bother me with work, right? It's
interesting.
How do I craft my life such that my work, which is a big part of my life, obviously, right? I really enjoy it. And quite frankly, it pays the bills, right?
Right, yeah.
But how do I immerse that into the other parts of my life, with my family, with my friends, for my health? At the end of the day, if I'm not healthy, nothing else kind of fits, right?
Right.
And so I think it's a big thing is realizing, one, the cadence of people you work with, right? And if they're morning people, if they're evening people, communication style, right? And also just being, again, proactive or vocal when there is something really important that you need to step out for, right? I got married a couple of months ago and my team's new and they said, okay, listen, you put your phone away, we're not going to bother you.
Right.
For these big life events, people who care will make an effort to care about that. And it's a big red flag if they don't, right? So
right.
You know, if I'm getting married and they're like, oh, you need to work at the altar, right? Maybe it's time for a different job. But I think more or less, in my experience, everyone in my firm has been super supportive of things like that. And yeah, I think it's just a matter of being proactive and being vocal about that.
And has there been a learning curve? I mean, one of the challenges that I personally had coming off first post-graduation, but especially coming off my clerkships, was I went from being like the person drafting these big opinions to being mm-hmm. sort of the, even on a leanly staffed team, the bottom person on the totem pole. And even those tasks were tasks that I had no idea how to do.
Yeah.
What has your learning curve been like and how have you sort of dealt with that change?
That's precisely how I felt when I started, right? And especially with some of the IP stuff that I do, right? I don't have a technical background. I majored in economics, right? So I do some stuff in life sciences or in tech cases, right? There is a very steep learning curve. But I think the best way to approach that is, I think no one expects a junior associate to know everything because they were once a junior associate. And I think for the most part, no one knows everything. The other thing is make an honest effort to try to figure things out yourself, right? There's that infamous memo that went around a couple of months ago, right?
Yeah, the slide, right? People were calling slide.
And so a lot of the stuff there, I think, is kind of overblown. One thing I think that was a point worth noting is just saying, I don't know, right, is probably not good enough, right? But you say, listen, I've checked X, Y, and Z thing. I can't quite figure this out. I think everyone's happy to help you there, right? Because the alternative is you don't ask, you submit something that's completely off base, and now people have to redo it, right? So, and I think the third thing is, to that point, is you learn a lot and you learn in ways you didn't, in a manner you don't think you've learned, right? So even when I look at stuff I wrote 3 months ago or 8 months ago, I realize how much I've improved since then, right? And I think that imposter syndrome of not being good enough never really goes away. But taking a second step back and realize like you are growing and you are improving is super helpful.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that I think people forget about is the balance between saying, I don't know, because by definition, you've never done this before and law school couldn't train you. And everybody has to, the joke I use in the podcast all the time is like, everybody has to land the plane for the first time. You just don't tell the passengers you're doing it. Like you have to have a first time and that's how you learn to do it. But at the same time, being willing to ask the follow-up question that doesn't lead you down a crazy rabbit hole is a challenge. And it's something that I think is hard to teach. You sort of have to like learn that balance. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's perfect, right? Actually, I love that analogy you just gave. That's pretty funny. I think what it comes down to is, especially at a big law firm, right, where you're billing by the hour, right? You going down a rabbit hole for 6, 7, 8, 9 hours isn't doing anyone any good,
right?
Because it doesn't help the people you're working with because the work product's getting delayed. It doesn't help the client, right? Because the bill is going way up. It doesn't help you because you're working late. And by the time you realize you actually need help, it's 2 a.m. and everyone's asleep anyway.
Right.
So the one kind of, it's not a hard and fast rule, but like a rule of thumb I use is if I've been assigned something and I've spent an hour or so, right? And I've looked at things like practical law, I've done, you know, Google searches, and we can talk maybe more about how I approach assignments, but like, I have no idea what's going on. Then I'll reach out to the mid-level or senior associate and be like, look, I've looked at X, Y, and Z thing. Particularly what you have done. Like, is there something I'm missing? Or what else, if you were assigned this thing, what would you do, right? Not telling you them to give you the answer, but tell you where to look, right? I'll show you the well, so to speak, where we get the water from.
I love that.
I think people are super receptive to that. Now, that shows initiative as well, right? It's being like cognizant of the fact that you gave your best effort, cognizant of the fact that you're a junior, and cognizant of the fact that there's people there to help. I think people will really, really appreciate that.
Right. And then they know that you have the pathway to the for the next time, and that's beneficial to them and beneficial to your clients and beneficial to you. Yeah. I mean, before we go down any rabbit holes, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how you think about dealing with a new project, because that's something that I try to teach to 1Ls. And frankly, I think it's hard for them to grasp in the moment of like, how do I handle a new project, whether that's a new type of document, a new area of law, a new set of facts. They're sort of still learning, like, what is a rule statement? How does it all fit in? Mm-hmm. How do you think about dealing with a new assignment?
Sure. So maybe I can give a, like, probably what the most common assignment they'll be assigned as a first,
perfect,
right? Which is a senior associate partner being like, I think there's some case law on X point. Can you find it for me? Right.
Right.
When I was clerking, my justice would do the same thing. Right. And by the way, that's why clerking is such a great experience, because all I did for a year was legal research and writing, right? And,
right?
And that's super helpful in private practice as well. So let's say I'm assigned a legal research question or issue, right? The first instinct for everyone is to jump on Westlaw, because that's what we did in law school, right?
Mm-hmm.
The thing to note though, right? In law school, you, for the most part, had a all expenses paid, search as much as you want account, right?
No time limits, no cost limits, nothing.
Right. You start in private practice, every search, every time you click enter, that's X amount of dollars, mm-hmm. right? Or every, however much time you spend, you know, depending on how the plan is organized with the firm. So you have to be efficient. And right. And so one, and also with your time, the more time you spend, right?
Yeah.
For yourself, the more you bill. So one thing I've actually done is take a little bit of time to kind of think about the research question. What actually is needed here? Okay, you figure that out. What's the best way to test that? I go on Google.
Yeah.
I'll search it up. Right. And sometimes what happened, and actually I would probably say maybe not 9 times out of 10, but maybe 6 or 7 times out of 10, there's a law firm guidance on that specific thing.
Right.
And when that happens, I thank God, because I'm like, this is saving me a lot of time. Right. Because usually right. some other firm has written on that specific issue and has cases on point. So what you don't want to do is rely on that and just give them the answer based on the thing. What you want to do is pull those cases.
Right. That's your starting point.
Yep. And so on Westlaw, you can do something, put FI colon and put the site, right? So whatever, like let's say 124 F3D, whatever, 395, whatever, right? They'll pull up the case for free. So the client's not getting charged for that. It's a, let's say it's a case from 2017 that's on point. I'll look at it. That's great. To make sure it hasn't been overruled or there's not better case law on point, you go to citing references, see the cases that cited it, see if it's in the relevant jurisdiction, see if it's reported, and take a quick look. And that at least will give you something to work with. Maybe that's not 100% on point, but it gives you a starting block. And from there, you can find other things. You can look at the head notes. And something that might have taken you hours or even days of your own research could take you a few minutes, right? And that's a big thing. I think in law school, everything is taught to you to be original, right?
Hmm.
And I think a big thing when you go to practice is Obviously, don't plagiarize. I'm not saying that, but there's no point of reinventing the wheel.
Right. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And frankly, I want to play this little clip for all of my students and any other one else listening. I think this is really good, right? Having that first case to start from is huge because it gets you in the right universe, right? The algorithms get you, the algorithms then know where you want to be looking. And a single case can be both a opportunity to see what happened after that case and what came before that case and sort of what was happening at the same horizontal level. So having that first case is huge. And if you can get it faster, you do your job better.
And honestly, a lot of times, all you need is one case, right?
Right.
I mean, sometimes you want to have a string side of four cases, but a lot of times, all they really want is one case on point just for to support a proposition, right?
Right.
And to that, you mentioned a really important point, which is you have 1Ls learning how to write rule statements. Mm-hmm. And that is so helpful as a junior associate because you want to be able to respond to the mid-level or the senior or the partner being like, I have found a case that supports a proposition that whatever.
Right.
Right. As opposed to just quoting a case and people look at that and be like, that's okay, but you're a lawyer. You should be able to analyze that, right?
Right.
Regurgitating ChatGPT can do, right? But the whole point of being a lawyer is to be able to analyze facts with law.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about fact development, because that was a big part, at least of my early time. And it wasn't, I did some document review, but it was much broader than that, right? It was going through documents, doing privilege logs, going through documents to prepare for depositions, things like that. What kind of work have you done sort of in the fact development space?
I think all those things you mentioned is typical junior associate work. I think the biggest thing is as a junior associate, people have mentioned to me that you're almost like the master of the facts, right? And that's where your biggest value can come in, right? Because—
Say more about that.
So like, for example, right? Let's say you're on a big investigation, right? And you know, you want to prepare what's called a chronology, right? Of like what was said when. If you can parse out what's the saying, like wheat from the chaff or whatever that saying is, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
The salient emails from the, you know, like happy birthday emails, right?
Right.
Prepare them in a chronology in a way that is intuitive, in a way that's super helpful for the partner or senior associate taking the deposition or taking the witness interview, and then being available for follow-up questions because you are the one who has directly seen those documents, right? Hey, has there been anything else that related to this event? Or what do they mean by this? It seems like there's an insider joke or whatever. And if you can get really good at that and not be fumbling every time someone asks you a question, you'll be worth your weight in gold.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I saw that time and again. The people who, instead of saying, ugh, I'm doing doc review or I'm doing a chronology or I'm prepping somebody else to take a deposition, if you can sort of do exactly what you said and become the master of the facts, at some point, and maybe it hasn't happened yet that often for you, I don't know, I'm curious, but like the fact that you are the master of the facts allows you to do a whole host of legal tasks much more quickly and much better. And frankly, you're ready once you have that fact development skill. Have you found that like being the master of the facts has helped you get better legal work?
Totally. And I think that what it comes down to is everyone is chomping at the bit to take the deposition, right? Everyone's chomping at the bit to cross-examine the witness at trial, whatever the case may be, right?
Right.
There's only X amount of those opportunities available. So if you're someone who's super diligent, who's super on it all the time, who really does good work product and things that maybe aren't the most glamorous, but are super necessary, site checking, chronologies, document review. If it's between you and someone who doesn't do that, the partner or senior associate will pick you every single time. You will be rewarded for that.
100%.
In the same way I mentioned before, you're training with Michael Jordan. The people who practiced with Jordan, who went hard with Jordan, became better basketball players.
For sure.
Maybe they weren't starting on the Bulls, right? But they became pretty good at their own skills.
Exactly. That makes a ton of sense. One of the other common challenges, I think, for junior associates is getting feedback, especially early on when you're, frankly, you don't know what you're doing yet. And so you get a lot of feedback. And even people who maybe haven't got so much negative feedback in their life before get feedback that they perceive to be negative or needing of change. Talk to me about how you've experienced feedback and maybe any lessons you've learned from that process.
I think the biggest thing I'll say is, look, I've gotten good feedback. I've gotten constructive feedback, right? I think everyone who's given me constructive feedback has given it in a meaningful way, in a constructive manner, right? And I'm super grateful for that. And the reason I'm super grateful for that is there's two things people can do when you do something incorrect. One is be like, this person sucks. I'm never talking to them ever again. And ignoring you, right?
Right.
And you never learn what you actually did wrong. Or, hey, listen, thanks for this. For the next time, keep this in mind and keep that in mind. Okay, great. Thank you so much. That helps me grow. It helps me learn. right? Same way when you go working out, right? When you work out, the only way you get stronger is by working to the point of complete muscle failure, right? And that's tough and that's hard, right?
Right.
To the point of getting feedback. It hurts our ego sometimes, right?
Yeah.
We send a draft brief out or whatever, and it comes back all in red and different colors, and five people have looked at it, so now it's red, yellow, green, blue, comments, you know, and track changes.
100%.
And, you know, partners are busy, right? So they send short emails, not mean to be rude or anything, right? It's just, you know, please fix, right? Yeah, we've all gotten those, right? I sent from my iPhone or whatever, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But you realize, like, that is how you learn. And I think the people who seek out feedback, who seek out constructive feedback, and who try to learn and implement that are people who other seniors love to work with, right? Because the senior associates and the partners realize that they were once in your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, you know, got feedback, and they also learned, and they also grew. And so someone who's willing to do that, they love it. And someone who's stuck in their ways and thinks, well, I know better than you, quite frankly, you don't, right? I mean, there's no way I, as a second-year associate, know better than someone who's practiced for 20 years. It's just not going to happen.
Right. I love that. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that is the hardest thing to train in young students. And frankly, it's the hardest thing that I still have struggle with getting feedback. I still sort of don't want to send out my academic articles to even people who I'm friends with for the fear of getting that, like, as you said, that like dripping multiple different colors on there, or worse, that somebody says to you, like, this is not even the right document. Like, we're not even in the right starting place, better yet in the right finishing place. But you're absolutely right. You can't learn without it. And yeah, I think that's right. Feedback should be accepted as the gift, even if the person giving it to you doesn't present it as a gift, maybe.
I think it's also like, in the same way in our personal lives, right? A real friend will tell you when you're going down a wrong path. A family member will tell you, listen, like, I saw you do this thing. I'm gonna be honest with you. That's not how you should be behaving. Our parents, right? My parents, when I was growing up, when they would see me do something wrong, they would sit me down and be like, listen, like, we know you can do better than this.
Right.
And it's because they approached me in a way of love, right? That I was like, you know what? They're right. And sometimes, you know, youthful arrogance, I'm like, no, I know better than you. And I realize now, I'm like, no, they were right. I was being a kid. In the same way, the workplace, right? I mean, I think it helps the seniors and the partners if I do a better job, right? And so when they're giving me feedback, it's not coming from a place of malice, right? Because, you know, I mean, look, at the end of the day, right? This is a business. They kicked me at the door if they wanted, right? They're keeping me here, so, and they're investing in my development because they want to see me improve for a number of different reasons.
Have you found any other tools or techniques for improving your written work product besides feedback, or besides written feedback from people above you?
You know, one thing I never believed in before that I started believing a lot more recently is printing out a hard copy and editing by hand. I thought this was, you know, like someone from the 50s talking about, you know, whatever, right? Like, back in that day.
How quaint, right?
Yeah. I was like, no, I can just read on my phone. I can read on the computer or whatever, right? There's something about looking at something in a hard copy and having a red pen or whatever, right? That, like, the typos, the grammatical errors, or even substantive, like, inconsistencies, right, jumps out at you. And so I think that's one thing I've started doing. And one thing, honestly, that I'm trying to improve on for myself is being more attentive to the details.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a junior associate, that's super important. And that's a skill that, again, quite honestly, I'm trying to improve on, right? And the thing is, right, when you're trying to improve on something, there's gonna be times where you fall a little short.
Right.
And as long as people see that you're making an effort, I think people will appreciate that.
Right. And you have to put yourself out there and do those things, right? It's easy to just say, well, I'm gonna do the things that I can do in my sleep, but you don't grow.
Mm-hmm.
But by definition, you're gonna fall short when you're doing new things. That's, again, hopefully you still land the plane, but it might be a little bumpier. I may have extended that metaphor far too far, but I think that's sort of what you're getting at.
Yeah. Look, I mean, if you only, right, so I clerked, right? And so I'm able to do legal research somewhat, I guess, well. But if the only thing I can ever do is find a case on point, I mean, as a mid-level senior, you have to help run the case. You have to take depositions. You have to argue a trial. All these things that I haven't done yet.
Right.
So, I mean, I can never get to that point unless I do those things for the first time. As you say, right, land the plane in whatever context for the first time.
And one of the questions that I ask, because I talk to a lot of law firm partners, as anybody who listens regularly knows, one of the questions I often ask is sort of like, what makes a great junior associate stand out?
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question for you is, what makes a great partner stand out?
I got to be careful. The partners going to listen to this podcast later on. No, I'm joking. I think the partners that I love working with are the partners who take the time to, I get everyone's busy, but take the time when times are a little bit slower to sit down and talk to me about their careers, about what they're seeing in me, parallels they see, differences they see, and ways I can improve, right? The biggest insight we can learn from people who are more senior to us, right? And that's both in the professional context with senior lawyers, but also in the personal context, right? With our, I come from a Muslim background, right? So the respect for elders is there, right? We look up to our elders like that. I honestly think that kind of like almost, the word is used as soft skills, right? But I think that's used as a pejorative way, but I think it's actually a super important thing, right? To take the 2 seconds to just recognize, hey, you sent this case. It was great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Even if that's sent from the iPhone that just says TY, that means more to me than a chunk of text, you know? And so those small like dopamine rushes of recognition is super powerful. And what that does, it motivates me to go 10 times harder for that person next time around.
Totally. As you say that, I'm literally thinking back. We're interviewing on a Friday afternoon, and I'm thinking back to a Friday afternoon when I was probably your level as a junior associate, where I got an email from someone I had worked for so many hours on this very complicated matter. And I got an email on Friday afternoon that, and all it said, and I think it was probably sent from the back of a taxi cab on the way back from a deposition, was, the work you've done, I remember it like it was yesterday. The work you've done on this case has made my life easier. I really, really appreciate it. And like for the next 2 years, all I wanted to do was work for that partner.
Yeah.
And I still am close with that partner to this day. And it's amazing how much of an impact feeling like you're seen and your work is seen. But also, I don't want to step on the thing you said earlier, which is also telling you when you're falling short or how you're falling short, especially when times are quiet. Right? It's easy in the moment to say, this isn't good enough. What's hard is later to say, this is how to make it better. And it sounds like those are the best partners in your mind as well.
100%, right? And I mean, to that point, it's been several years since you worked on that matter and got that email.
Yeah.
And the fact that you remember it like it was yesterday, just shows that like, I mean, it's human nature to want approval, right? And I think that's why negative
100%.
Feedback
hurts. 100%.
So when you get those positive things, it shows that your work matters, right? And I think being at a big law firm, sometimes I think the critique is, right, that you get lost in the sauce, so to speak, right? But when you see the case you cited and the rule statement you created for that case being put in the brief, I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. Like, I contributed to a public filing. That's cool.
Right, exactly. And the that's cool feeling just slowly gets to be more of your job as you get more experience when it's done right. I think it's not always done right, but
exactly. It
sounds like you've been lucky to have it done mostly right, which is pretty great. I was sort of looking at your LinkedIn posts, and you've had a couple over the last year, and one really stuck out at me. I think it was 6 months ago or so. And you wrote that one of your mentors, Judge Zia Faruqi, who sits here in DC, who I'm a huge fan of, said that his motto to live by is ABN, always be networking. And that's something that you often think about. And I guess I'm curious, sort of practically speaking, how do you think about networking and mentorship building as a junior? And how has that sort of played an impact in your legal career?
I think, as I mentioned before, if not the first, one of the very few lawyers from my community, you know, when I was going to law school, right? There weren't many people that looked like me who I could relate to, right? But there was people above me, a few of them, who really took the time out to help and mentor me. Judge Faruqi is one of them. There's a great partner at A&O, Sammy Mir, great guy as well. Asim Rahman, I don't know if you know him. He's the chief administrative law judge in New York. So I think in terms of networking, right, I think people give it a negative reputation, right? It's lazy, you know, giving me a job type of thing. I don't really think about it, right? I think about it as making a personal connection and less so about what can you do for me and more so how can I help you get to what your goals are, whether on a, be on a professional or personal level. Judge Faruqi has always been available for me, has always been someone who I can bounce ideas off of, can get advice from, right? And one thing he told me was, more or less, I'm paraphrasing, but like, you're a junior associate, but you can be what I am to you, to so many people who are in law school right now, who are thinking about going to law school right now, who are in high school right now, or whatever the case may be.
Hmm.
And so to the extent that I can, I try to be available to people of all backgrounds, but especially people from underrepresented groups, to be that sounding board, right? And to help guide them to the extent that I can. And if there's anyone listening to this who would love to chat, I'm always happy to talk to law students, talk to junior people, I was talking to a high schooler yesterday, you know what I mean? Talk to anyone who could use a second opinion or something.
I love that. I love the idea. I mean, I think about this a lot. The idea is whenever somebody says, thank you for what you've done to help me, my answer is always just pay it forward to somebody else. That's the greatest thanks I can have, because I too have been lucky Obviously, we come from different backgrounds at different times and different places, but like I too have been lucky to find some people who are willing to sort of tell it to me real when I really needed to hear it.
Yep.
And I try to pass that on both on the show and outside of it. And so I think that's fantastic. And I think the other point that I want to highlight, and I also want to get your take on before I let you go, is I think that sometimes the most valuable mentors are not the people who are 10 years ahead of you. They're the people 2 or 3 years ahead of you. Mm-hmm. And you're already playing that mentoring role, even though you're relatively junior in the career. How do you think about that idea of sort of how far ahead your mentor should be and how far behind your mentee should be?
I think the Appella Project does it the best, right? And so I'm a mentor in the Appella Project and a former mentee as well, the first class actually. And so the way we do it in the Appella Project is there is a senior appellate lawyer. There is someone who's either clerking or just out of a clerkship like myself, and there's a law student. And the beauty of that interaction is, I don't know, right? The head of appellate practice at X firm or at a nonprofit, right, has years of experience, has argued 30 times for the Supreme Court, whatever, and can talk about that. But when the law student talks to me, I can give them more practical advice about, hey, you're considering doing clerkships. If you want to do appellate work, a state Supreme Court is a great opportunity.
Right.
That may or may not be accessible in the same way a federal court of appellate clerkship is for a number of different reasons. And I think that's super valuable, right? You know, as you mentioned, the proximity that I have to, you know, the clerkship process benefits a law student, right? In the same way that a law student can help advise a pre-law student way better than I can right now, right? Because
right.
I applied to law school, God, what year was that? Like 2017 or whatever year that was. So I don't remember how I prepared for the LSAT. I don't remember how I did personal statements in the same way that someone who's a 2L right now mm-hmm. does.
I love that. And I think it's so great. And I'll just stand on my soapbox for 1 minute. And if you happen to be listening to us 47 minutes into the show and you haven't yet talked to somebody behind you or helped somebody behind you, like go do it because you gain exponentially more and you're helping our profession. And I just think that's such great advice and so well put. And I really appreciate it. So we're coming to the end of our time. And I always end my episodes by asking for a piece of advice, something you wish you knew when you were in law school or maybe just getting started that you know now, or sort of the advice you're giving to people who are just sort of starting their legal careers and legal journeys.
I think the biggest thing I would say, and to this point we've been talking about a lot, is you can either be a gatekeeper or a door opener. And what I mean by that is I think our profession gets a bad rap. And I think there are, unfortunately, some people in our profession who choose to erect barriers and who choose to have the mentality of, well, I had to go through it, so you should too. And then there's also people who say, well, I had to go through this rough experience. And so if I can make it easier for someone else coming behind me, it's incumbent upon me to do that. And I think at every level, whether you're a senior partner at a law firm, whether you're a junior associate, whether you're a law student, whoever you are, you have the opportunity to open the doors, right? To, I don't know if the right word is destroy, right? But destroy the barriers that exist.
Right.
And there's so many great organizations doing that you don't need to reinvent the wheel, but you can help out, right? The Appella Project, we mentioned that a lot of times, right? That's a great organization doing great work, right? There's affinity bar associations. There's so many opportunities to help make a difference in someone's life. And I think it's the one parting piece of advice I'll give people, and it sounds cheesy or whatever, right? But like being kind is free, but it's super valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And this job is super stressful, right? And people will make mistakes. We're all human. I've made mistakes. You've made mistakes. You will be around people who make mistakes. And showing kindness in times of stress is way more valuable than being kind. I know I can be kind to people in a normal situation, right? But being kind when it's maybe more instinctual to be angry or mm-hmm. more instinctual to be upset, you know, shows your true character. And I think to the extent you can emulate that in law school with your classmates as a junior attorney or even as the head of a litigation group at a large law firm, right? Your character will speak volumes. And look, at the end of the day, our profession is large, but also small, right? And making a reputation as someone who is kind, who is generous, who brings people together is super valuable.
I love that. I love both of those messages, both being kind in the hardest moments and being a door opener and not a gatekeeper. Look, this has been super fun. Thank you so much for being here and for agreeing to join me. And I wish you the best of luck on your career. And I can't wait to see where it goes. So thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Awesome. Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or @JonahPerlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.